Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, is the debate over Obamacare over? So, Richard, the first open enrollment period for Obamacare has now come to an end, and you've got the president and members of his administration doing a bit of a victory lap with the announcement that they've signed up about 8 million people for the program. And the president, in a moment of triumphalism, says the debate over repealing the law is over. So we'll get into other aspects of this in a moment, but let's just start narrowly there with those sign-up numbers. Other things in the plan might be flawed, but can you at least say that those 8 million or so who signed up for Obamacare will at least be better off?
No, you can't say that at all. The question is where they come from. Many of the people who signed up for these particular plans, particularly on the individual mandate side, were booted off their earlier policies. Since the alternative was legally barred from them by the Obama administration, the only thing you could say is that they're better off with his particular program than they were without any kind of insurance whatsoever. But since there was never a head-to-head contact between the so-called substandard policies, which many people actually preferred, and the ones that are offered on the exchanges, you can't make any judgment about that at all. There's also another reason why you can't be very confident about this. Most of those people who were on these earlier plans were on them for many years. And when you're starting to look at the current situation, it's much more complicated. And the reason for the complexity is we have no idea at this point in time what the rates are going to look like next year, because it's going to depend on experience which is yet to be gathered about the way in which these plans operate generally. And if the price on these plans starts to go up, there's nothing which says that there won't be a disenrollment coming next year so that the 8 million could shrink. And the last point that one would make is that this is very much an aggregate figure, which puts in the extension of the Medicare numbers along with the exchange numbers. And when you do that, of course, you then have to ask the question as to whether or not you could have had the Medicaid extension without doing what was done with respect to the private plans. And the answer to that question is yes. The constitutional debate that took place over the Obamacare bill and the Medicaid extension was only over the question as to whether or not, if you didn't sign up, you had to forfeit federal funds for all the other customers who were already in the plan. Nobody ever doubted if that provision was removed that you could expand Medicaid rolls. It's a policy judgment as to whether it's a good or a bad thing, but it's a very different policy judgment about the Medicaid situation than it is about the individual and the employer mandate, which, by the way, is yet to go into effect.
Richard, what about the demographic mix here? I mean, the drumbeat that we've heard all along is that Obamacare needs the young and the healthy to sign up in order to cross-subsidize the older and the infirmed. And the target number for these, they call them young invincibles, was about 40%. It looks like the actual number we're going to see is something closer to around 28%. To the extent that we can tell, because a lot of this is still vague, what is that likely to mean actuarially for Obamacare going forward?
Well, first of all, even if you assume that everybody in the 28% turns out to be a random draw of that subset of the population, it means that you're basically short by about a third of the number of people you need to keep this thing in balance. Since the bottom end, in fact, is now going to be underprovided for, it means that premiums are going to have to raise across the board. As they start to raise across the board, even those young invincibles in the 28% will start to have second thoughts. They may peel off, and you could still have what has been called somewhat dramatically the adverse selection death spiral, as all of the people whose risk are lower than their premiums disappear and all the people whose risk are higher than their premiums climb on. So there's nothing about the initial sign up which guarantees any degree of stability for the program, given the right to remove yourself at will from the list. The second point that one has to note is that we have no confidence whatsoever that the people who are, quote, young invincibles are in fact the ones who signed up. The whole theory of adverse possession says that you'll never get a random draw when you have this situation. So chances are the people who are signing up in the sort of the under 35 group are going to be those people who on average have worse health care than a random draw from the same population. That means that the size of the cross-subsidy is going to be smaller, which means that the pressure on premiums is going to be larger. Can this thing be stabilized? Well, the answer is if you put enough public funds in from other sources, you could probably do this. But one of the things that the president never talks about is the amount of money in direct subsidies that has to go into signing these people up. And those are going to count into the billions of dollars. If you look at the total numbers, given both the Medicaid and the Obamacare sign-up programs, uninsured numbers are down a tiny fraction, but there's still well over 40 million people, I believe.
Richard, if we take the president seriously when he says that the debate is over, how do we go about even arguing that? But how do you meaningfully form some preliminary judgment on Obamacare when, as you mentioned a moment ago, so many aspects of it have been delayed? I mean, of course, the individual mandate and the employer mandate have both been significantly altered from where they first stood. You even had the president's former press secretary, Robert Gibbs, saying earlier this month that he doesn't think the employer mandate will ever take effect. So how interconnected are those factors? Can the president just jettison requirements like that and still make this work?
Well, I mean, what happens is it's a work in progress. I attacked much of this program way back in 2013 and 2012. Some of its aspects have probably been changed because there's constant government by waiver. But the basic essential difficulties, I think, are still there. There's been no movement in order to reduce those things which are listed as minimum essential benefits with respect to these programs. And that's going to create a real difficulty if you give people all the kinds of services they don't want and skimp on the services they do want. In order to supply the very large benefit package, what you have to do is to reduce the number of choices that people have. And we know from the HMO scare of the 1990s that people don't like to have reduced choices as to points of access within the system. The Obama administration essentially forces you to have comprehensive coverage, but it doesn't regulate where you supply that coverage, where the portals are, and that generally is going to be a source of consumer dissatisfaction, and it may well lead a lot of people to withdraw from these plans if it turns out that the inconvenience associated with their operation is going to become too great. There are also many complications of so-called medical loss ratios, how much money you could spend on administrative expenses before you have to start to pay a penalty. The Obamacare statute makes the terrible mistake of assuming that there's some abstract number at which you should cap these expenses, everything above that being waste. A normal firm tries to ask whether or not at the margin the next dollar is best spent in administration or in direct provision of health care. If, in fact, you get serious refunds coming into this situation, there could easily be problem with the insurers making their nut and keeping viable. It's worth noting that, the day after the president announced that the debate was over, United Health, which is a very big operation, reported that its per share earnings were down from about 35 cents on $1.50 per share for the last quarter, largely because of Obamacare expenses. And if these expenses keep going up, it's as I said in the column that I wrote, you don't make up the loss on each piece by increasing the total volume. So the large numbers, in effect, could be a real sign of fiscal imbalance rather than a sign of fiscal strength, because we don't know enough about the composition of the pool. But the theory tells us that we're actually heading for trouble.
So, Richard, as people on the left try to figure out how to deal with Obamacare as a political issue, because you've got the midterm elections coming up, one of the tactics that you're seeing emerge is an attempt to sort of evade questions about Obamacare as a system and to instead focus narrowly on the aspects of it that are popular, allowing young people to stay on their parents' insurance until they're in their mid-20s, covering people with pre-existing conditions, getting rid of lifetime limits on benefits, covering more people under Medicaid. How should people like yourself, who don't like the law as a whole, deal with these narrower issues where it does seem like the president and his allies on these narrow fronts may actually be on the right side of public opinion and may be responding to sort of a genuine desire within the electorate?
Well, I think the first thing one points is to ask whether or not the popular features would have been included in general policies wholly without regard to the mandates from the government. Now, on this particular point, I think it's pretty clear that if you're looking at, for example, keeping people on to 26, that turned out to be such a hit. The cost generally involved in those things are pretty low. My guess is voluntary plans would have done it anyhow, or in the alternative, if for some reason they would not be able to get the message, there's nothing which says that you can't separate that from the entire system. The point is you can't defend the bad parts of the Medicare by pointing to the good parts unless you show that the two are completely inseparable. And in this particular case, it's quite clear that the division is remarkably easy. With respect to pre-existing conditions and community rating, there's a real intellectual debate as to whether or not this makes sense. A first point to note is that at least with respect to certain forms of pre-existing conditions, they've been sort of covered by standard insurance policies since the 1996 reforms and a statute called HIPAA having to do with exactly these questions of renewal. It has never been a hugely great problem looking at individual cases. The real problem, which the president doesn't want to mention, is with respect to the community rating, where you squinch the differences between the top and bottom of the pool so they no longer reflect the actuarial cost of the two sides. And that has created repeated death syndromes everywhere you look, like in Washington, D.C., with respect to the individual policy market. Ironically, in New York State, where the business has been fairly brisk, the reason is that the New York law was more restrictive than the federal law. It had a 1-to-1 ratio, which just killed the individual market. At 3-to-1, you could start seeing some people start to creep back in. So one of the great defenses of Obamacare is it's a form of deregulation in some jurisdictions, even though it's a form of regulation in other jurisdictions, because they have different baselines from which you manage what's going on. As to the Medicaid stuff, I think, again, you want to separate that out. If you want to increase Medicaid, you don't have to do it in the kind of weird half back-ended way that was done in the Health Care Act. You could simply do it as a general federal appropriation like everything else, and then we could fight about that. There are many questions about how you reimburse for various kinds of expenses under Medicare. That's not going away anytime soon. So what happens is you have to evaluate those separately. And again, there's no reason why, if you can improve payment systems, you have to do it through a statute which completely wrecks the private voluntary market. The real battle here has always been over the question of the individual mandate and the employer mandate. One of these things is very perilous, and the other, the employer mandate, as has been said, may never go into effect, because the differences between what that statute seems to require and what the what those plans normally give and what the statute seems to require may be an unbridgeable gap. And if that turns out to be the case, the whole system will start to fall apart, because the individual mandates are under 15% of the market. The really big part is on the employer side.
To that point, this will be my final question for you. There are, it seems to me, a few ways that you can look at the future of Obamacare. One, of course, is the administration's line that it'll be a success. We already know we can't put you in that camp. But there is some division amongst its critics as to whether the thing collapses of its own weight or just sort of slowly bleeds us out in a way that, while yeah, it may be painful, is not sufficiently dramatic to undo it. In other words, it settles into an equilibrium where those folks who want a more market-based approach are deeply unhappy, but it's not bad enough to catalyze the broader public into the kind of revolt that might engender repeal, or at least large-scale changes. Which of those outcomes do you think is more likely, and what are likely to be the variables that make the difference there?
Well, I think it's more likely to be the second than the first. I mean, the president is a pretty astute politician, and he doesn't have some kind of irresistible death urge. He's shown repeated willingness to waive various portions of the plans that seem to be unattractive under this statute. And we had earlier on all the experience with the mini-med plans, in which it turns out that waivers were given to all sorts of companies so as to make sure that their low-wage employees actually had some coverage under this. So I think what's going to happen is you're going to continue to see a pattern of studied retreat with respect to the statute, which may ease certain kinds of requirements without making any fundamental changes. And they'll do so in order to avoid a complete catastrophe. But the real question is going to be, is if this thing hurts enough so that people are disgruntled and are generally displeased with the Democratic administration, say because of the larger economic situations, there could be a a change in the political regime. And the moment you start to put Republicans in charge of this thing and give them the same size scope with respect to executive power discretion that Obama's claimed for himself, you don't have to repeal the statute. You could chop it into 1,000 small pieces, and one after another, you can toss them aside and leave essentially a burning hulk as opposed to having an operating statute. And there's a very strong liability, strong possibility that that will take place. One of the things that the president didn't note, and which is still an open question, is whether or not if you, for example, try to enforce the employer mandate, you'll see a real change in the number of people who are able to gain employment. Those numbers have stuck very rigidly. Unemployment numbers are down, but labor participation is down as well. So it's basically we haven't moved in the fraction of the population employed in the last 5 or 6 years associated with this ostensible recovery from the last recession. If the employment effects turn out to be fairly major, there will be, I think, a more concerted effort to sort of modify this particular program. The Democrats, I think, can block any repeal, but I don't think that they can block a slowdown in executive branch enforcement.
All right, Richard, thank you as always, and thanks to our listeners. Remember, you can find Richard's weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. You can buy his most recent book, The Classical Liberal Constitution, The Uncertain Quest for Limited Government, and you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. For the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is a production of the Hoover Institution. Thank you for listening.